night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the match.
He did the monster match.
The monster match.
It was a graveyard smash.
Ah, monsters, monster mashes. Monsters have been scaring us for centuries. We're going to talk about a few of them today with our guest, Larry Mueller here. My guest, Carolyn Betcha. She is an author, illustrator, and graphic designer. Her award-winning children's books include The Raucous Royals, I Feel Better with a Frog in My Throat, and They Lost Their Heads. And her latest is the one we're going to be talking about. It's called Monstrous: The Lore, Gore, and Science Behind Your Favorite Monsters. So what monster scared you when you were young? Did you still get creeped out a little bit? We'd love to have you join in the conversation here. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're too scared, you could send us an email. Go to ideas@wpr.org. Carolyn Betcha joins us by phone. Carolyn, do I have your first name pronounced properly?
It's Carlin, like George Carlin.
Carlin. All right. Yep. I won't forget the rest of the way, I promise. This is such a fun book.
Part of my job
here at the University of Wisconsin is that I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication. And one of the things that we work on a lot is how to best provide science information to all groups of people, including young people. And I think your book does a wonderful job communicating some science. And frankly, it may be a children's book, but I learned some things and I really had a good time with it.
Well, I learned a lot too when I was researching. So that was the objective, to appeal to all ages.
Ah, man. I'm sure it'll appeal to all ages. And what did you want to teach kids with this book?
Well, the takeaway that I really wanted to give readers was to encourage critical thinking. And what I mean by that is I want them to question their surroundings. If they're scared of something, I want them to ask why. I want them to cogitate on why something is fearful and pick it apart. Vampires, they're maybe not be scary. But if you lose blood, yeah, that's
scary.
You should know what to do. Godzilla, he's fun and campy. A nuclear fallout, yeah, that's for real. You should pay attention on what you should do. So it's all... It was designed to be able to allow readers to decipher what is scary and what is not, to empower them.
Well, talk about the book a little bit. What are readers going to find when they look into it?
Well, they're going to learn how to survive the zombie apocalypse, which, you know, zombies are trending right now, and it's very important. Kids, do not eat the brains. We don't want to eat brains because you could get a deadly disease, prion disease, called Kuru. They can learn about werewolves. If they're out trick-or-treating tonight and a werewolf approaches them, there's a spread on how to communicate with a werewolf. And it just so happens that all the same techniques you can also use on scary dogs.
Oh, man. You know, I like how you started the book. You know, right away off the bat, you talk about being scared and what happens to your body and your brain when you're scared, that sort of fight or flight thing.
Yeah, it may seem like a philosophical place to start, but I want readers to understand what's going on in our brains when we feel fear, because I want readers to respect fear. Fear is important because fear keeps us alive. Our ancestors who did not fear that saber-toothed tiger, they were eaten, so they didn't get their genes passed on. So I want them to understand that in their brains, their amygdala activates and it causes a split-second response called fight or flight. And then from there, all these neurotransmitters are released, like dopamine. And if they understand what is going on in their brain, then they also can understand the logical parts of our brain, prefrontal cortex, which kicks in once all those fight or flight responses calm down. And I want them to use their prefrontal cortex.
And, you know, you think about it, I as I was reading about that, I thought about some of the research, that communication research that had been done in the past on what they call the cocktail party effect, because we are always monitoring our surroundings. And the cocktail party effect, of course, is that you're at a party and everybody's talking. It's loud. You're trying to concentrate on the person you're talking to. And then you hear your name. Somebody mentions your name behind you and you heard it, even mm-hmm. though you were concentrating on something else. And so we're kind of constantly monitoring our environment, whether we know it or not.
Yeah, our brains are a complex organ, mm-hmm. and they're changing so rapidly now that, I mean, neuroscientists can't even keep up with the understandings of our brain.
And in the book, you say that, you know, science really is stronger than fear. Talk about what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is if you understand a fear, then it's less complicated. It's less scary. And an example I give is fairy tales. Fairy tales were designed to approach fear in a contained way. Like the Big Bad Wolf could be a really scary tale, but he's really about the bestiality and monster inside us. So I want kids to understand what exactly they're fearing. And if they understand it, then science can be a lot more powerful than fear.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right about that. So what were some of the most surprising things you discovered while you were writing this book?
Well, one of the stories that I found poignant, maybe because I wasn't as familiar with it, was the tale of Godzilla. You know, we think of the fashion of a bikini. It's a very innocuous fashion. You don't think of the origins of the bikini, that it came out of this real tragedy.
Yes.
When we were testing on the Bikini Atoll Islands, and that's where we get the name of the bikini, you know, dropping the bombshell. They even called that. They called it that fashion, you know, bombshell fashion. And, you know, it seems to us playful, but to Japanese audience, it was a very poignant story. And that was surprising to me, how one culture can take a monster and translate it one way, and then another culture can translate it another way. But there's this universal emotion that fear is everywhere.
Yeah, it's Godzilla was, I'm trying to remember all the different things that he would breathe out, nuclear waste or mm-hmm. nuclear energy.
Yep, he has nuclear breath.
Nuclear breath. That's what that was the term that I was trying to come up with. But you're right. We, you know, I've watched those movies. You probably have too. They never really scared me at all.
Yeah, I didn't find Godzilla scary. I did find Frankenstein scary as a child, and maybe that was me personally, but there's something visceral about Frankenstein when he comes to life and it's dark and gritty, and you really see the emotions in his face. And I think some of the horror movies today, with all the special effects, we kind of lose that character acting. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there's an interesting story that you tell about Mary Shelley, when you're writing about Dr. Frankenstein and how she came to write that piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how great works of art come together in the most bizarre way. So for those who aren't familiar with the story, they're all Lord Byron, Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, and a bunch of the other writers, including their doctor, Polidori. They're all locked up inside their house because Mount Tambora has just erupted, and it was called the Summer of Darkness because it was so much eruption from this volcano that people couldn't even go outside and the sun was blackened out. So Lord Byron, being Lord Byron, he doesn't like to be bored. He wants to be entertained, and he suggests a ghost story challenge to the group. Who here can write the most blood-curdling tale? And, you know, Percy Shelley already had some notoriety at the time, and Lord Byron was practically a rock star. Mary Shelley was just a wisp of a girl who had never written anything, and she stepped up to the challenge. That's when she wrote Frankenstein. And it's interesting to me, but, you know, people may be familiar with that tale, but at the same time, the first vampire tale was also written at that party by the doctor. So it's just fascinating that these kids are all sitting around, what, you know, writing. You know, we have got so much distractions today. Maybe we should just lock our kids up and make them write ghost stories.
Well, I absolutely love that story. I really didn't know the whole particulars of it, and so I thought, man, is that interesting, and especially to get the vampire out of the same essentially night.
Yeah. And he based that tale on Lord Byron, so he put all these little innuendos in there that everybody at the time knew he was writing about. And the reason why he did that is because Lord Byron and him were fighting, and Lord Byron eventually fired him, and he decided to take revenge writing to the paper. So, you know, it's funny that book was actually attributed to Lord Byron for a while, and he was like, no, I didn't write it, but... You know, he's basing my character on me.
Well, let's go to Frankenstein for a minute here. What's the science behind it?
Yeah, so Frankenstein, I decided to attack the electricity behind the Frankenstein story, because we have to remember that electricity is ubiquitous to us, and we don't really think much of an everyday item like it. But the first time people saw electricity, it was used for entertainment. And it scared them so much because they had never seen anything like it. People would have these electrical parties, and what they would do is they would take an orphan boy, and they would tie him up, and they'd use static electricity so that his hands could attract all this gold leaf and feathers. And to audiences then, that seemed like magic to them. And then it wasn't magic. It was just static electricity. But then at the time, they decided, well, if electricity could do this, what if we used electricity to, say, bring a corpse back to life? So there was a scientist at the time. His name was Giovanni Aldini, and he convinced London officials to give him a corpse to practice on. And he made it a spectacle. He had an entire audience. And you can imagine, you know, this darkened room and this criminal. He had murdered his wife, supposedly. And he's sitting on this slab, and he starts running electrical current through his ears, through his butt, through, you know, all parts of his body. And, of course, when you run electricity through muscles will twitch. Even dead bodies will twitch. So audiences see this body, like, start to twitch. And then twitch a little bit more, and then the legs start flare, and they think the man's coming back to life. And then he just stops, and they realize that the person hasn't been brought back to life. But it opens their minds to think, well, what could electricity do? And then Mary Shelley, we don't know if she was at any of these electrical parties, but her latter husband, Percy Shelley, he had an electrical machine that he would take out of his desk. And he would entertain guests with it. At one point, he accidentally electrocuted the family cat. So it's believed that Mary Shelley drew inspiration from these electrical parties.
Oh, my goodness me. Carlin Decha, our guest today, she is the author of Monstrous, The Lore, Gore, and Science Behind Your Favorite Monsters. She's going to be with us right up until about 12:20 today. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Ever wonder where the tales of werewolves or the Kraken came from? It's Halloween, so we're talking about monsters today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest is Carlin Decha. She is an author, illustrator, and graphic designer. She's the author of a number of award-winning children's books, and her latest title is Monstrous, The Lore, Gore, and Science Behind Your Favorite Monsters. So, what questions do you have about monsters? You have a favorite? Do you like monster movies? What about the science behind those monsters? She does a wonderful job talking about the science behind them. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Carlin, Joe in Washburn, Wisconsin, emailed that the mummy, or as they called him, the walking bandages, was his most feared as a child. Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi were the best. When he was a kid in Chicago, a TV program every Saturday night called Shock Theater was featured. And they featured Jerry Bishop, a local radio announcer, was a moderator. They even had a band called the Deadbeats.
That's awesome.
Great entertainment, a very poor night's rest as a child.
I'll tell you an interesting little science tidbit about mummies. For the longest time, they were used in medicine. It was believed that they were a panacea for all your ills. So we were grinding up mummies, Egyptian mummies, real artifacts, left and right, and ingesting them. So that makes it a little less scary, more on the gross side.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, you mentioned zombies, and I loved your map on page of, I don't remember the page. Anyway, it's the states where you are most likely to be eaten by a zombie, and we're in the safe zone in Wisconsin.
Oh, you're lucky, because I'm in Boston, and Boston is definitely a high zombie takeover area.
And you actually had some criteria for this.
Yeah, so you would be surprised how much information you can find off the CDC. In fact, they did something brilliant a few years ago. They put out this zombie apocalypse plan, and I sourced them in the book, of course. Yeah. But what they were trying to do is they were trying to get the public prepared for pandemics and epidemics. So you understand the brilliance behind that, because they were using this tongue-in-cheek approach that this is how you would survive a zombie apocalypse. But it's also how you would survive any viral outbreak. I mean, when the 1918 Great Influenza outbreak happened, if we had done some of these things, then we would have been in a lot better shape.
Yeah, and it was like population data, a walking score, the ability of the Walking Dead to get around and lead to higher infection rates.
Yep, and whether or not there's hardware stores nearby, because chainsaws will protect you against zombies. The show Mythbusters did a special on this where they actually tested out what was the quickest way to kill zombies, and they found the chainsaw was by far the most effective way to take down the zombie horde.
Much better than guns.
Much better than guns. We don't need guns. We just need chainsaws.
Oh, my goodness. I want to go back to Frankenstein, because this, to me, this gets at some of the science that you talk about, and it has to do with electricity. So talk a little bit more about how you work electricity into this, and how if you tried what Dr. Frankenstein tried, you'd probably be frying brains.
Yes, exactly. So I decided to pick apart, would Dr. Frankenstein's machine work? And when I talk about Dr. Frankenstein, I'm referring to the movie, not the novel.
Yeah.
So at the side, if you'll notice in the movie, he's got these, some people think they're electrodes, some people think they're bolts, but they're on the side of his neck, and that's where the electrical current goes through. Now, if you were to run an electrical current through the skin right at the neck, you would fry someone's brainstem. And as kids will learn in the zombie chapter, you need your brainstem in order to breathe. That's a basic function of breathing. So then I decided to take it full circle, because I pick apart the machine and how it won't work. But then if you think about it, we do use electricity to bring people back to life. We use defibrillators today. So, I didn't know this, but maybe you do. You know when in medical TV dramas where you see a person hooked up to an EKG?
Yeah.
And it's beeping steady, beep, beep, and then all of a sudden it goes, and flat lines. And all of a sudden the doctors start running around and seeing, screaming code red or whatever. Yeah, so that would never happen. Unfortunately, an EKG indicates a flat line, so no amount of electricity is going to get that heart beating again. Because what an EKG does is it disrupts the unnatural rhythm to get the heart beating again. So I talk about that in the book, how we do use electricity, but not in the way maybe you see it on TV.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's great, and with the blood too. I don't drink the blood. You talk about that and talk about the various types of blood and so forth, which I thought, what a great way to get that information out.
Well, you should drink blood if you're a vampire bat.
Yep.
But if you're not a vampire bat, stay away from blood. Because first of all, blood has iron in it, which is very poisonous. Our bodies can't break down that much iron. So, and if you are going to drink blood, do not, if you become a vampire, do not go after the arteries, because arteries pump blood away from the heart, so there's more pressure. So if you puncture an artery, it's going to spurt, and it's going to make, you know, those, like, those love scenes in vampire movies where they're, like, you know, they're drinking out of the neck? They're drinking from the vein. If they go after an artery, like the carotid artery, it's not going to make the scene as romantic.
It's going to be a lot messier, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. And, I want people to imagine a romantic scene with their vampires.
Nick in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Nick. Thanks for calling. Oh, we lost Nick.
I guess I scared him away with all my artery dots, burning artery dots.
It looks like we have him, so let's try again. Nick, are you there?
This is Nick.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, I just had a question for you. I was just wondering, because I just tuned in, as I'm in this thing, snowstorm. I was just wondering how many, like, monsters or villains are based on real-life people in historical events.
And real events, okay.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because, and this has been debated ad nauseum, where Stoker based Dracula on. And of course, there was a Prince Dracula who was known for a lot of heinous crimes. And he used to stake people and just basically leave their bodies hanging out on fields on stakes to scare people off. And we know from Stoker's note that he borrowed the name of Dracula from that prince. But what a lot of people have supposed that where Dracula might have based his character on was his boss, Henry Irving. I mean, the way he describes Henry Irving is exactly like how he describes Dracula in the book. And they had this really sort of pained relationship. So Stoker was Irving's stage manager, or sort of like his personal assistant, and he would read all his letters. He was his lackey. And Irving kind of, he treated him like a lackey. So it's believed that Stoker also might have done a little revenge writing and might have based his character on his boss. So if you don't like your boss, I always say just write a novel about them.
You can always kill him off in the novel
exactly.
Or make him a monster for
yep.
Sure. Nick, thanks. Ted in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. See, I just wondered if you had talked about when I was young, I remember a radio program. And it was, I think, out of Little Rock, Arkansas, and it was called Beaker Theater. And it not necessarily always really scary, but it was suspenseful. And it was, God, I just enjoyed that so much as a kid.
Hmm. Do you know that one, Carlin?
No, I don't. I tried to stick to really popular monsters because my age range is more tween-teen.
Yeah, I gotcha. So we don't have any information on that one, Ted, because I don't know that one either. I did want to talk about math and monsters with you,
yes.
And specifically King Kong.
Yeah, so I was the kid, I don't know about you, but I hated math as a child. And
yeah.
My dad used to teach me all my math problems. So I decided I'm going to make math fun for kids. And one of the concepts that's, you know, it's kind of hard for kids to grasp is the square cube law. And it basically, the square cube law makes King Kong absolutely impossible. For those who might not be familiar with it, who might have been math haters like me, it basically says that as an object area gets larger, its volume increases in direct proportion, but at a greater rate. So what that would mean is that as if you take a gorilla and you size it up to King Kong's size, his bones can't support that weight and volume, so he would basically turn to goo underneath his own weight. And I want kids to start, you know, thinking like, oh, wow, I could actually use math to pick apart monsters, you know, and decide if they're real or not.
Yeah, he couldn't even pick up Fay Wray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, there's a funny, like, illustration in the book where she's screaming in his hand. And, it says in a little bubble, this isn't real. I'm really scared. And she actually really was scared because that mechanical hand would sometimes not operate correctly and drop her.
Oh, my goodness. The Kraken has been the villain in many Hollywood films. What's a Kraken?
Yeah, so the Kraken, another one that I'm particularly scared of because, I don't know about you, but anything in the ocean, I'm not a good swimmer. So And I grew up with Jaws, too. So
yeah.
Anything in the ocean is super, super scary to me. So the Kraken, I believe, is probably an example of deep sea gigantism. And, you know, I'm not going to dismiss the Kraken either. I actually think there might be a giant squid or colossal squid that we will eventually find that is of tremendous size. But the history of the Kraken is that people would find on whales these kind of frisbee marks on the side of them. And they would think, well, you know, the whale's the biggest sea creature. What could be attacking a whale? And then they would find these little, this waxy rock along the beach called ambergris. And ambergris is used in perfumes, not in the United States, but it's still in French perfumes. And it was so expensive at the time, it was worth more than gold. So they would, when the whaling industry was at its height, they would open up whales and they would find the ambergris trapped inside the whale. It's basically just a squid's bony beak that can't be digested. So it gets trapped in the whale's intestine and it gets coated with this ambergris. So then it either comes out of the mouth or the whale poops it out. And then at the time, its smell isn't worth anything. But over time, as it floats along, It starts to develop, as you would say, and it gets this wonderful odor to it, and it's still used in expensive French perfumes. But I do have to tell people because it's worth a lot of money even today. There was a young boy in the UK who found a small piece, and it was worth $55,000. Yeah. So, but if you find ambergris in the United States, you cannot keep it because whales are still considered endangered.
Wow. Well, the octopus comes into play. I have a 16-year-old daughter, and she wants to be a marine biologist, and she loves cephalopods, and particularly octopus.
Yeah, so octopus are fascinating because they're so intelligent. And, you know, there was this one zoo where this happens in a lot of aquariums where the octopus will sneak out of its cage and go to the tank, and it will go to neighboring tanks. It will eat all the other sea creatures, and then it will sneak back into its own tank. That's how smart octopuses are. They remember people, too. So it's actually possible that the Kraken could be an octopus, too.
Well, it's interesting. I guess we used to wrestle octopus.
Yeah, it seems cruel now, but in the 1960s, it became a big sport. So divers would jump into waters, and whoever captured the largest octopus would win. And you can imagine that this probably upset a lot of octopuses, and it's now outlawed. You can't. Well, actually, you can catch an octopus if you plan to eat it. So there's a page in the book about how to tell if you're about to be eaten by a giant octopus, and it's basically the body language of an octopus. And they have a very exquisite body language. Like, they will raise their mantle, that's the bulbous part of its head, if they get angry. They will get large if they get angry. They change color, which most people know about, and they squirt water. They also can inject poison. So there's a lot I think we don't know about octopuses, which we'll learn in the future.
Well, you have done a wonderful job, Carlin, with this book and the illustrations. And you illustrated yourself. It's just absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about it. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you as well. Carlin Betcha, our guest today, and her book is titled Monstrous, The Lore, Gore, and Science Behind Your Favorite Monsters. And there's so much. She talks about glow-in-the-dark pigs and spider silk goats, and she talks about how somebody can become a crazy cat lady. There's something to do with the smells that cats when they eliminate, and that smell gets into the boxes, and when you're cleaning the boxes, some of that gets into your nose, and if there's a lot of it, you can maybe you can become a cat lady. Who knows? Oh my goodness! Well, you know what? We're lucky to live in a state with so much going on, and so much so that we've started a new monthly segment where we'll feature some great places and events to explore throughout the state. And it's time to think about inside events. And here's something worth checking out.
Autumn brings many activities to our state. Fall festivals, apple picking, pumpkin farms, and hay rides abound. And occasionally, we find an event that is so unique it only happens in one place. On this month's Time Out Wisconsin, we're going to Watertown to tell you about the Harvest Ball that's put on by the First Brigade Band. With us is the organizer of the event, Greg Davis. Hi, Greg. Thanks for coming in. Why don't you tell us about the First Brigade Band?
Well, the First Brigade Band is a recreation of a band that actually, the original band came from Broadhead, Wisconsin. It was the Broadhead Town Band. And the entire band up and enlisted in the Army in 1864, if you can imagine such a thing.
Wow.
They were assigned to the 15th Army Corps, the 3rd Division, the 1st Brigade, and they wound up marching with General William T. Sherman on his march through northern Georgia and the Carolinas, his famed March to the Sea. So that's what we do. In 1964, the band was recreated and has been performing ever since then. So more than 50 years we've been doing this, and we actually have our piccolo player has been in the band more than 50 years.
That's incredible. Why don't you tell us the unique thing about your group is the instruments, isn't it?
The instruments are, in fact, a very unique part of our group. They're all actual antique instruments from the era of the Civil War. When you hear our instruments play, you hear music just as it was heard by Abraham Lincoln, William T. Sherman, all of those folks. In fact, we actually have an instrument that we know belonged to the original 1st Brigade Band, and that band went to the Douglas Lincoln debates in Illinois and played for them. So we're pretty sure that Abraham Lincoln actually heard this horn play.
Kind of gives you goosebumps, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Well, we had mentioned the ball, and that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. So why don't you talk about what the Harvest Ball is, and why is it different than most other dances that someone would go to?
Well, first of all, the 1st Brigade Band plays at it, so you're going to hear music that was played during the Civil War. We don't play anything that was performed after the Civil War. No disco, no nothing like that. And you're going to hear it played on our authentic antique instruments. So you're hearing what was heard back then. The dances that we do may be a little different, certainly not disco dances. We do schottisches and polkas and waltzes and grand marches. Virginia reels get people's hearts pounding and the sweat flowing. Everybody has a good time with them. Many people who come to our ball come in period dress, so the ladies in hoop-skirted ball gowns, the gentlemen in either civilian period attire, evening attire, or period military uniforms. We don't insist on that, however. We encourage it, but we don't insist on it because our charter is to not only perform for people but to educate them, and so we'd rather have them come and learn about what we do and about the period than insist on them being in appropriate dress. So
how much is the ticket?
The tickets are $40 per person. If you buy them in groups of eight, you get a 25% discount mm-hmm. off that. We also have sandwiches, kind of light food mm-hmm. fare during the evening. We usually draw for a few door prizes, and there's also a cash bar available if you're into that.
You need some liquid courage
to
get out of
it. Some liquid encouragement, right. Yep, so.
And where can people go to get the tickets?
People can get tickets at our website, which is firstbrigadeband.org, and that's 1STBRIGADEBAND.org. Or they can get them via email at sales@firstbrigadeband.org, or by phone at 920-262-1864.
Well, great. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing that with us, and good luck.
It's been my pleasure, Jill. Thank you so much.
Again, the Harvest Ball is on November 2nd in Watertown, and you can find out more and purchase tickets by going to firstbrigadeband.org, or you can call 920-262-1864, and again, that's November 2nd. Here are a few other events you may want to check out. On November 2nd and 3rd, you can experience the excitement of sled dog racing on dry land in Pearson, Wisconsin. You'll see teams with bikes, scooters, carts, and dogs partnered with running mushers. On November 14th, you can attend Telebration in La Crosse. Join this global celebration with an evening of international folktales presented by local tellers. And if you're in the Appleton area in the next few months, check out the exhibit Guitar, the Instrument That Rocked the World. You can see it at the History Museum at the Castle. That is just a very few of the many events taking place around the state in the next few weeks. If you have an event you'd like to tell us about, email us at timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org and find links to the events we talked about today at wpr.org/timeout. I'm Jill Nadeau. Until next month, get out and explore, dream, and discover.
And thanks to Jill for bringing that to us. Jim Hoyt, was a good friend of mine, played in the First Brigade Band, and I heard them play many times and always enjoyed it. Well, again, timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org. That's the place to go to tell us about your event. Tomorrow it's Garden Talk time. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.